Penguin Random House Canada presents Acts of Murder by L.R. Wright. Read for you by Peter Outerbridge, Kristen Krug, Lisa Bunting, Maya Lowe, Khadija Roberts-Abdullah, Alora Patnaik, Veronica Ortihuela, Rachel Cairns, Derek Kwan, Sonia Vaillant, and Caleb Stull. This book is for John. What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. T.S. Eliot, Little Gidding.
May 1985, Abbotsford, B.C. Mrs. O'Hara, driving to work, reached a certain point on the road that crossed the floor of the Fraser Valley and pulled over, because from here was available one of the finest sights she knew, especially on such a day as this. It encompassed Mount Baker and its attendant peaks, and bumpy, low-slung green hills, and a row of poplar trees that had been there as long as she could remember, languidly sweeping the springtime sky in concert with the breeze, and herds of cattle, too. The sky was an unusually deep, radiant blue that morning. Royal blue, it was. A pulsating concentration of blue. This was the second most important thing that happened to Mrs. O'Hara that day, savoring the sight of the mountains and the poplars and the sky, and the sweet sense of spring that drifted in through the car window. It was late evening and almost dark when she got home. As she pulled up in front of the house, she was immediately enveloped by a stillness that was deep, fragrant, and significant. The porch light was on, spilling bright light upon the rickety staircase. Above her, stars pierced the darkness that wasn't black, but navy. She could see no lights on inside the house, which stood tall and narrow and melancholy. Mrs. O'Hara felt an odd compassion for it at that moment, and into her head came strange notions like buying it new curtains or painting its exterior, all the while knowing that camouflage wasn't the answer. She got out of the car and closed the door, quietly, respectful of the hush of twilight, and headed across the yard. In her right hand, she carried her purse and a plastic bag that contained her waitressing shoes. She was aware, as she approached the house, of the extraordinary, tender warmth of the evening. She started up the steps, gripping the railing with her left hand, and the tiny diamond in her wedding ring glinted in the harsh light from the porch. She looked down at the steps and saw her feet, uncomfortable in dark brown pumps. She was more than halfway up the staircase when the door at the top was abruptly opened. Mrs. O'Hara had heard nothing, had thought her husband, Tom, was out. She looked up quickly, stumbling in her shock, and her hand flew from the railing as she lost her balance. Tom was standing directly beneath the light, so that from her vantage point, his nose, his chin, his cheekbones flung small darting shadows upward, distorting his face. And where the light struck his pupils, she saw a glint of astonishment. Behind him, slightly shorter than he, huddled against his back like a shadow, was a white specter with long pale hair. Mrs. O'Hara's shoe bag and her purse went flying as she grabbed wildly for the railing. Her hands brushed it, missed it, and she felt herself falling backward down the steps. She wondered if the fall might kill her, and hoped it would not hurt. It didn't kill her, but it knocked her out. Not for long, but long enough for the specter to vanish. 1995, Sechelt, B.C. 1. Wednesday, February 1st. Mrs. O'Hara nudged her old VW van along the road that led to her first house of the day, a residence several miles inland from Seashelt, out of sight of the sea. The wipers shuddered weakly across the windshield and back again, and Mrs. O'Hara fiddled impatiently and unsuccessfully with the heater controls. She had wakened in a bad humor, depressed and dissatisfied, and had been tempted to grant herself a mental health day. She was a disciplined woman, however, and hadn't considered this possibility for long. She had begun, 4 years earlier, when she turned 60, to pace herself, to take on just as much work as she needed, no more, no less. She could afford to do this because her wants were few. She didn't smoke, she didn't drink. She hadn't had to give up either of these habits. She had never found them particularly interesting. The only vice that had seriously tempted her was marijuana. But Mrs. O'Hara considered extremely dangerous anything that robbed her of comprehension and control, and had firmly triumphed over her urge to smoke pot. She needed food, and books, and money with which to maintain her house and her vehicle, and an occasional amount for clothes. And that was about it. No, Mrs. O'Hara didn't worry about not having enough money to support herself. Especially since she had only 18 months left to live. She would die, she knew, on or around her 65th birthday. Both her parents had done so. Mrs. O'Hara had no siblings, but if she had had a brother or a sister or two, she knew that they, too, would have died when they were 65. She didn't know why. Until recently, this fact had not bothered her much. It had certainly relieved her of worry about the concerns associated with growing old. Some of those concerns, however, were visiting her already. She was afflicted with arthritis, for example, and this was distressing. As she turned off the main road onto a narrower one, pressed upon by woods that dripped rain in what Mrs. O'Hara perceived to be an excessively mournful fashion, she fretted again about the task that had to be completed in the next year and a half, despite her arthritis and her declining vigor. Mrs. O'Hara was a tall woman, large, with long, thick, gray hair and dark eyes, pouched. Her throat was wattled, and her face was deeply lined. But she paid no attention to these things. She kept herself clean and presentable, and her clothes were unpretentious. Mrs. O'Hara thought herself humble, and called her pride by other names, called it self-reliance and conviction. The rain had stopped, at least temporarily, by the time she reached the Granger's house. She was about to pull into their driveway when she saw that Mrs. Granger's car was there, so she drove past the house and parked at the side of the road. She climbed out of her van and hauled back the side door to unload her supplies, and heard the dog barking. She had a certain amount of trepidation about this dog. She had never been an animal lover, and found people who flaunted friendly anthropomorphic relationships with dogs embarrassing. Mrs. O'Hara stopped what she was doing and gazed thoughtfully across the top of the van at the woods on the other side of the road. It had just occurred to her that 10 years ago she wouldn't have known that word, anthropomorphic, and now here it came spilling into her head, calmly and surely. She had made good use of these years, the final decade of her life. She had created a brand new existence, one that was centered, admittedly, around service to others, but one that had also tended to the critically important cleansing and refinement of her own character. She straightened, pulling her ribcage up and her shoulders back, grateful for the strength and suppleness she still possessed, and swung closed the van's side door. She picked up the pails containing her cleaning supplies and strode across the grass toward the Granger's porch. The dog was bounding excitedly back and forth on the cement driveway in front of me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?